Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Section 5 of The Son of the Wolf by Jack London. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain, read by Ben Tucker. To the Man on the Trail.
Dump it in. But I say, kid, isn't that going a little too strong? Whiskey and alcohol's bad enough, but when it comes to brandy and pepper sauce and dump it in, who's making this punch anyway?
And Malamute Kid smiled benignantly through the clouds of steam. By the time you've been in this country as long as I have, my son, and lived on rabbit tracks and salmon belly, you'll learn that Christmas comes only once per annum. And a Christmas without punch is sinking a hole to bedrock with nary a pay streak.
Stack up on that for a hock yard,
approved Big Jim Belden, who had come down from his claim on Maisie May to spend Christmas, and who, as everyone knew, had been living the 2 months past on straight moose meat.
I ain't forgot the hooch we uns made on the Tanana, hey ya?
Well, I guess yes. Boys, it would have done your hearts good to see that whole tribe fighting drunk. And all because of a glorious ferment of sugar and sourdough. That was before your time, Malamute Kid said as he turned to Stanley Prince, a young mining expert who had been in 2 years.
No white women in the country then. And Mason wanted to get married. Ruth's father was chief of the Tananas and objected like the rest of the tribe. Stiff? Why, I used my last pounder of sugar. Finest work in that line I ever did in my life. You should have seen the chase down the river and across the portage.
But the squaw?
Asked Louis Savoy, the tall French-Canadian, becoming interested, for he had heard of this wild deed when at 40 Mile the preceding winter. The Malamute Kid, who was a born raconteur, told the unvarnished tale of the Northland Lochinvar. More than one rough adventurer of the North felt his heartstrings draw closer and experienced vague yearnings for the sunnier pastures of the Southland, when life promised something more than a barren struggle with cold and death.
We struck the Yukon just behind the first ice run, he concluded, and the tribe only a quarter of an hour behind. But that saved us, for the second run broke the jam above and shut them out. When they finally got into Nuckluck Yoto, the whole post was ready for them. And as to the foregathering, asked Father Robeau here, he performed the ceremony.
The Jesuit took the pipe from his lips, but could only express his gratification with patriarchal smiles, while Protestant and Catholic vigorously applauded.
"By gar!"
ejaculated Louis Savoy, who seemed overcome by the romance of it.
"La petite squaw! Mon maison brave! By gar!"
Then as the first 10 cups of punch went round, Bettles, the unquenchable, sprang to his feet and struck up his favorite drinking song.
There's Henry Ward Beecher and Sunday school teachers all drinking the sassafras root. But you bet all the same if it had its right name, it's the juice of the forbidden fruit.
Oh, the juice of the forbidden fruit, roared out the Bacchanalian chorus. Oh, the juice of the forbidden fruit. But you bet all the same if it had its right name, it's the juice of the forbidden fruit.
Malamute Kid's frightful concoction did its work. The men of the camps and trails unbent in its genial glow, and jest and song and tales of past adventure went round the board. Aliens from 12 lands, they toasted each other and all. It was the Englishman, Prince, who pledged Uncle Sam, the precious infant of the New World, the Yankee Bettles, who drank to the Queen, God bless her, and together Savoy and Myers, the German trader, cleaned their cups to Alsace and Lorraine. Then Malamute Kid arose, cup in hand, and glanced at the greased paper window, where the frost stood full 3 inches thick.
A health to the man on the trail this night. May his grub hold out, may his dogs keep their legs, may his matches never miss fire.
Crack! Crack! Heard the familiar music of the dog whip, the whining howl of the Malamutes, and the crunch of a sled as it drew up to the cabin. Conversation languished while they waited the issue.
An old-timer cares for his dogs and then himself, whispered Malamute Kid to Prince as they listened to the snapping jaws
and the wolfish snarls and yelps of pain which proclaimed to their practiced ears that the stranger was beating back their dogs while he fed his own. Then came the expected knock, sharp and confident, and the stranger entered. Dazzled by the light, he hesitated a moment at the door, giving to all a chance for scrutiny. He was a striking personage, and a most picturesque one, in his arctic dress of wool and fur, standing 6'2" or 6'3", with proportionate breadth of shoulders and depth of chest, his smooth-shaven face nipped by the cold to a gleaming pink, his long lashes and eyebrows white with ice, and the ear and neck flaps of his great wolfskin cap loosely raised. He seemed, of a verity, the Frost King, just stepped in and out of the night. Clasped outside his Mackinaw jacket, a beaded belt held two large Colt's revolvers and a hunting knife, while he carried, in addition to the inevitable dog whip, a smokeless rifle of the largest bore and latest pattern. As he came forward, for all his step was firm and elastic, they could see that fatigue bore heavily upon him. An awkward silence had fallen, but his hearty, "What cheer, my lads!" put them quickly at ease, and the next instant Malamute Kid and he had gripped hands. Though they had never met, each had heard of the other, and the recognition was mutual. A sweeping introduction and a mug of punch were forced upon him before he could explain his errand. "How long since that basket sled with 3 men and 8 dogs passed?" he asked. "And even 2 days ahead. Are you after them?" "Yes, my team. Run them off under my very nose, the cusses. I've gained 2 days on them already. Pick them up on the next run." "Reckon they'll show spunk?" asked Belden in order to keep up the conversation, for Malamute Kid already had the coffee pot on and was busily frying bacon and moose meat. The stranger significantly tapped his revolvers.
"When'd you leave Dawson?"
12 o'clock.
"Last night?"
"As a matter of course." "Today." A murmur of surprise passed round the circle, and well it might, for it was just midnight, and 75 miles of rough river trail was not to be sneered at for a 12 hours' run. The talk soon became impersonal, however, harking back to the trails of childhood. As the younger stranger ate of the rude fare, Malamute Kid attentively studied his face. Nor was he long in deciding that it was fair, honest, and open, and that he liked it. Still youthful, the lines had been firmly traced by toil and hardship. Though genial in conversation and mild when at rest, the blue eyes gave promise of the hard steel glitter which comes when called into action, especially against odds. The heavy jaw and square-cut chin demonstrated rugged pertinacity and indomitability. Nor, though the attributes of the lion were there, was there wanting the certain softness, the hint of womanliness, which bespoke the emotional nature.
"So that's how me and the old woman got spliced,"
said Belden, concluding the exciting tale of his courtship.
"Here we be, Dad," says she. "And may ye be damned," says he to her, and then to me, "Jim, ye got out in them good duds of yourn. I want a right pert slice of the 40-acre plowed for dinner." And then he sort of sniffled and kissed her, and I was that happy, but he then seen me and roared out, "Eh, Jim, and you bet I dusted for the barn."
"Any kids waiting for you back in the States?" asked the stranger.
"Nope, Sal died for and he come, that's why I'm here."
Belden abstractedly began to light his pipe, which had failed to go out, and then brightened up with,
"How about yourself, stranger, married man?"
For reply, he opened his watch, slipped it from the thong which served for a chain, and passed it over. Belden picked up the slush lamp, surveyed the inside of the case critically, and swearing admiringly to himself, handed it over to Louis Savoy. With numerous by-gars, he finally surrendered it to Prince, and they noticed that his hands trembled and his eyes took on a peculiar softness. And so it passed from horny hand to horny hand, the pasted photograph of a woman, the clinging kind that such men fancy with a babe at the breast. Those who had not yet seen the wonder were keen with curiosity, those who had become silent and retrospective. They could face the pinch of famine, the grip of scurvy, or the quick death by field or flood. But the pictured semblance of a stranger woman and child made women and children of them all.
"Never have seen the youngster yet. He's a boy, she says, and 2 years old," said the stranger as he received the treasure back.
A lingering moment he gazed upon it, then snapped the case and turned away, but not quick enough to hide the restrained rush of tears. Malamute Kid led him to a bunk and bade him turn in.
"Call me at 4 sharp, don't fail me,"
were his last words, and a moment later he was breathing in the heaviness of exhausted sleep.
"By Jove, he's a plucky chap,"
commented Prince.
3 hours sleep after 75 miles with the dogs and then the trail again. Who is he, Kid?"
"Jack Westendale. Been in going on 3 years with nothing but the name of working like a horse and any amount of bad luck to his credit.
I never knew him, but Sitka Charlie told me about him.
Seems hard that a man with a sweet young wife like his should be putting in his years in this godforsaken hole where every year counts two on the outside.
The trouble with him is clean grit and stubbornness. He's cleaned up twice with a stake, but lost it both times. Here the conversation was broken off by an uproar from Bettles, for the effect had begun to wear away. And soon the bleak years of monotonous grub and deadening toil were being forgotten in rough merriment. Malamute Kid alone seemed unable to lose himself, and cast many an anxious look at his watch. Once he put on his mittens and beaverskin cap, and, leaving the cabin, fell to rummaging about in the cache. Nor could he wait the hour designated, for he was 15 minutes ahead of time in rousing his guest. The young giant had stiffened badly, and brisk rubbing was necessary to bring him to his feet. He tottered painfully out of the cabin to find his dogs harnessed and everything ready for the start. The company wished him good luck in a short chase, while Father Robeau, hurriedly blessing him, led the stampede for the cabin. And small wonder, for it is not good to face 74 degrees below zero with naked ears and hands. Malamute Kid saw him to the main trail, and there, gripping his hand heartily, gave him advice.
"You'll find 100 pounds of salmon eggs on the sled," he said. "The dogs will go as far on that as with 150 feet of fish, and you can't get dog food at Pelly as you probably expected."
The stranger started, and his eyes flashed, but he did not interrupt.
"You can't get an ounce of food for dog or man till you reach Five Fingers, and that's a stiff 200 miles. Watch out for open water on 30-mile river, and be sure you take the big cut-off above La Barge."
"How did you know it? Surely the news can't be ahead of me already."
"I don't know it, and what's more, I don't want to know it. But you never owned that team you're chasing. Sitka Charlie sold it to him last spring, but he sized you up to me a square once, and I believe him. I've seen your face. I like it. And I've seen... Why, damn you, hit the high places for salt water and that wife of yours, and..."
Here the kid unmittened and jerked out his sack.
"No, I don't need it."
And the tears froze on his cheeks as he convulsively gripped Malamute Kid's hand.
"Then don't spare the dogs. Cut them out of the traces as fast as they drop. Buy them and think they're cheap at $10 a pound. You can get them at Five Fingers, Little Salmon, and Hootalinqua. And watch out for wet feet," was his parting advice. "Keep a traveling up to 25. But if it gets below that, build a fire and change your socks."
15 minutes had barely elapsed when the jingle of bells announced new arrivals. The door opened and a mounted policeman of the Northwest Territory entered, followed by 2 half-breed dog drivers. Like Westendale, they were heavily armed and showed signs of fatigue. The half-breeds had been borne to the trail and bore it easily, but the young policeman was badly exhausted. Still, the dogged obstinacy of his race held him to the pace he had set, and would hold him till he dropped in his tracks.
"When did Westendale pull out?"
he asked.
"He stopped here, didn't he?"
This was supererogatory, for the tracks told their own tale too well. Malamute Kid caught Belden's eye, and he, scenting the wind, replied evasively,
"Right pert while back."
"Come, my man, speak up,"
the policeman admonished.
"You seem to want him right smart. Has he been getting cantankerous down Dawson way?"
"Held up Harry McFarland's for $40,000. Exchanged it at the PC store for a check on Seattle. And who's to stop the cashing of it if we don't overtake him? When did he pull out?"
Every eye suppressed its excitement, for Malamute Kid had given the cue, and the young officer encountered wooden faces on every hand. Striding over to Prince, he put the question to him. Though it hurt him, gazing into the frank, earnest face of his fellow countryman, he replied inconsequentially on the state of the trail. Then he espied Father Robeau, who could not lie.
"A quarter of an hour ago," the priest answered, "but he had 4 hours' rest for himself and the dogs."
15 minutes start and he's fresh! My God!"
The poor fellow staggered back, half-fainting from exhaustion and disappointment, murmuring something about the run from Dawson in 10 hours and the dogs being played out. Malamute Kid forced a mug of punch upon him, then he turned for the door, ordering the dog drivers to follow. But the warmth and promise of rest were too tempting, and they objected strenuously. The kid was conversant with their French patois and followed it anxiously. They swore that the dogs were gone up, that Sawash and Babette would have to be shot before the first mile was covered, that the rest were almost as bad, and that it would be better for all hands to rest up.
"Lend me 5 dogs,
he asked, turning to Malamute Kid. But the kid shook his head.
"I'll sign a check on Captain Constantine for 5,000. Here's my papers. I'm authorized to draw at my own discretion."
Again the silent refusal.
"Then I'll requisition them in the name of the Queen,"
Smiling incredulously, the kid glanced at his well-stocked arsenal, and the Englishman, realizing his impotency, turned for the door. But the dog driver, still objecting, he whirled upon them fiercely, calling them women and curs. The swart face of the older half-breed flushed angrily as he drew himself up and promised in good round terms that he would travel his leader off his legs, and would then be delighted to plant him in the snow. The young officer, and it required his whole will, walked steadily to the door, exhibiting a freshness he did not possess. But they all knew and appreciated his proud effort, nor could he veil the twinges of agony that shot across his face. Covered with frost, the dogs were curled up in the snow, and it was almost impossible to get them to their feet. The poor brutes whined under the stinging lash, for the dog drivers were angry and cruel. Nor till Babette, the leader, was cut from the traces could they break out the sled and get under way.
A dirty scoundrel and a liar.
By gar, him no good. A thief, worse than an Indian.
It was evident that they were angry, first at the way they had been deceived, and second at the outraged ethics of the Northland, where honesty above all was man's prime jewel.
And we gave the cuss a hand after knowing what he did.
All eyes turned accusingly upon Malamute Kid, who rose from the corner where he had been making Babette comfortable, and silently emptied the bowl for a final round of punch.
"It's a cold night, boys, a bitter cold night," was the irrelevant commencement of his defense. "You've all traveled trail, and know what that stands for. Don't jump a dog when he's down. You only heard one side. A whiter man than Jack Westendale never ate from the same pot nor stretched blanket with you or me. Last fall he gave his whole cleanup, 40,000, to Joe Castrell, to buy in on Dominion. Today he'd be a millionaire. But while he stayed behind at Circle City taking care of his partner with the scurvy, what does Castell do? Goes into McFarland's, jumps the limit, and drops the whole sack. Found him dead in the snow the next day. And poor Jack laying his plans to go out this winter to his wife and the boy he's never seen. You'll notice he took exactly what his partner lost, 40,000. Well, he's gone out. And what are you going to do about it? The kid glanced round the circle of his judges, noted the softening of their faces, then raised his mug aloft. So, a health to the man on trail this night. May his grub hold out, may his dogs keep their legs, may his matches never miss fire. God prosper him, good luck go with him, and...
Confusion to the mounted police,
cried Bettles to the crash of the empty cups. End of section 5. Section 6 of The Son of the Wolf by Jack London. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Ben Tucker. The Priestly Prerogative. This is the story of a man who did not appreciate his wife, also of a woman who did him too great an honor when she gave herself to him. Incidentally, it concerns a Jesuit priest who had never been known to lie. He was an appurtenance, and a very necessary one, to the Yukon country. But the presence of the other two was merely accidental. They were specimens of the many strange waifs which ride the breast of a gold rush or come tailing along behind. Edwin Bentham and Grace Bentham were waifs. They were also tailing along behind, for the Klondike rush of 97 had long since swept down the Great River and subsided into the famine-stricken city of Dawson. When the Yukon shut up shop and went to sleep under a 3-foot ice sheet, this peripatetic couple found themselves at the Five Finger Rapids, with the City of Gold still a journey of many sleeps to the north. Many cattle had been butchered at this place in the fall of the year, and the offal made a goodly heap. The three fellow voyagers of Edwin Bentham and wife gazed upon this deposit, did a little mental arithmetic, caught a certain glimpse of a bonanza, and decided to remain. And all winter they sold sacks of bones and frozen hides to the famished dog teams. It was a modest price, they asked, $1 a pound, just as it came. 6 months later, when the sun came back and the Yukon awoke, they buckled on their heavy money belts and journeyed back to the Southland, where they yet live and lie mightily about the Klondike they never saw. But Edwin Bentham, he was an indolent fellow, and had he not been possessed of a wife, would have gladly joined issued in the dog-meat speculation. As it was, she played upon his vanity, told him how great and strong he was, how a man such as he certainly was could overcome all obstacles, and of a surety obtained the golden fleece. So he squared his jaw, sold his share in the bones and hides for a sled and one dog, and turned his snowshoes to the north. Needless to state, Grace Bentham's snowshoes never allowed his tracks to grow cold. Nay, ere their tribulations had seen 3 days, it was the man who followed in the rear, and the woman who broke trail in advance. Of course, if anybody hove in sight, the position was instantly reversed. Thus did his manhood remain virgin to the travelers who passed like ghosts on the silent trail. There are such men in this world. How such a man and such a woman came to take each other for better and for worse is unimportant to this narrative. These things are familiar to us all, and those people who do them, or even question them too closely, are apt to lose a beautiful faith which is known as eternal fitness. Edwin Bentham was a boy, thrust by mischance into a man's body. A boy who could complacently pluck a butterfly wing from wing, or cower in abject terror before a lean, nervy fellow not half his size. He was a selfish crybaby, hidden behind a man's mustache and stature, and glossed over with a skin-deep veneer of culture and conventionality. Yes, he was a clubman and a society man, the sort that grace social functions and utter inanities with a charm and unction which is indescribable, the sort that talk big and cry over a toothache, the sort that put more hell into a woman's life by marrying her than can the most graceless libertine that ever browsed in forbidden pastures. We meet these men every day, but we rarely know them for what they are. Second to marrying them, the best way to get this knowledge is to eat out of the same pot and crawl under the same blanket with them for, well, say a week. No greater margin is necessary. To see Grace Bentham was to see a slender, girlish creature. To know her was to know a soul which dwarfed your own, yet retained all the elements of the eternal feminine. This was the woman who urged and encouraged her husband in his Northland quest, who broke trail for him when no one was looking, and cried in secret over her weakling woman's body. So journeyed the strangely assorted couple down to Old Fork Selkirk, then through 50 miles of dismal wilderness to Stewart River. And when the short day left them, and the man lay down in the snow and blubbered, it was the woman who lashed him to the sled, bit her lips with the pain of her aching limbs, and helped the dog haul him to Malamute Kid's cabin. Malamute Kid was not at home, but Myers, the German trader, cooked great moose steaks and shook up a bed of fresh pine boughs. Lake, Langham, and Parker were excited, and not unduly so when the cause was taken into account.
"Oh, Sandy, say, can you tell a porterhouse from around? Come out and lend us a hand, anyway."
This appeal emanated from the cache, where Langham was vainly struggling with divers quarters of frozen moose.
"Don't you budge from those dishes," commanded Parker.
"I say, Sandy, there's a good fellow. Just run down to the Missouri camp and borrow some cinnamon," begged Lake.
Oh, hurry up, why don't—"
But the crash of meat and boxes in the cache abruptly quenched this peremptory summons.
"Come now, Sandy, it won't take a minute to go down to the Missouri."
"You leave him alone," interrupted Parker. "How am I to mix the biscuits if the table isn't cleared off?"
Sandy paused in indecision till suddenly the fact that he was Langham's man dawned upon him. Then he apologetically threw down the greasy dishcloth and went to his master's rescue. These promising scions of wealthy progenitors had come to the Northland in search of laurels, with much money to burn, and a man apiece. Luckily for their souls, the other two men were up the White River in search of a mythical quartz ledge. So Sandy had to grin under the responsibility of 3 healthy masters, each of whom was possessed of peculiar cookery ideas. Twice that morning had a disruption of the whole camp been imminent, only averted by immense concessions from one or the other of these knights of the chafing dish. But at last their mutual creation, a really dainty dinner, was completed. Then they sat down to a 3-cornered game of cutthroat, a proceeding which did away with all casus belli for future hostilities, and permitted the victor to depart on a most important mission. This fortune fell to Parker, who parted his hair in the middle, put on his mittens and bearskin cap, and stepped over to Malamute Kid's cabin. And when he returned, it was in the company of Grace Bentham and the Malamute Kid, the former very sorry her husband could not share with their hospitality, for he had gone up to look at the Henderson Creek mines, and the latter still a trifle stiff from breaking trail down the Stewart River. Myers had been asked, but had declined, being deeply engrossed in an experiment of raising bread from hops. Well, they could do without the husband, but a woman. Why, they had not seen one all winter, and the presence of this one promised a new era in their lives. They were college men and gentlemen, these 3 young fellows, yearning for the flesh pots they had been so long denied. Probably Grace Bentham suffered from a similar hunger. At least, it meant much to her, the first bright hour in many weeks of darkness. But that wonderful first course, which claimed the versatile lake for its parent, had no sooner been served than there came a loud knock at the door.
"Oh, ah, won't you come in, Mr. Bentham?"
said Parker, who had stepped to see who the newcomer might be.
"Is my wife here?" gruffly responded that worthy.
"Why, yes, we left word with Mr. Myers."
Parker was exerting his most dulcet tones, inwardly wondering what the deuce it all meant.
"Won't you come in, expecting you at any moment? We reserved a place, and just in time for the first course, too." "Come in, Edwin, dear,"
chirped Grace Bentham from her seat at the table. Parker naturally stood aside.
"I won't, my wife,"
reiterated Bentham hoarsely, the intonation savoring disagreeably of ownership. Parker gasped, was within an ace of driving his fist into the face of his boorish visitor, but held himself awkwardly in check. Everybody rose. Lake lost his head and caught himself on the verge of saying, "Must you go?" Then began the farrago of leave-taking. "So nice of you. I am awfully sorry. By Jove, how did things brighten? Really, now, you. Thank you ever so much. Nice trip to Dawson, etc., etc." In this wise, the lamb was helped into her jacket and led to the slaughter. Then the door slammed and they gazed woefully upon the deserted table. Damn! Langham had suffered disadvantages in his early training, and his oaths were weak and monotonous.
"Damn!"
he repeated, vaguely conscious of the incompleteness and vain struggling for a more virile term. It is a clever woman who can fill out the many weak places in an inefficient man, by her own indomitability, reinforce his vacillating nature, infuse her ambitious soul into his, and spur him on to greater achievements. And it is indeed a very clever and tactful woman who can do all this, and do it so subtly that the man receives all the credit and believes in his inmost heart that everything is due to him and him alone. This is what Grace Bentham proceeded to do. Arriving in Dawson with a few pounds of flour and several letters of introduction, she at once applied herself to the task of pushing her big baby to the fore. It was she who melted the stony heart and wrung credit from the rude barbarian who presided over the destiny of the PC Company. Yet it was Edwin Bentham to whom the concession was ostensibly granted. It was she who dragged her baby up and down creeks, over benches and divides, and on a dozen wild stampedes. Yet everybody remarked what an energetic fellow that Bentham was. It was she who studied maps, and catechized miners, and hammered geography and locations into his hollow head, till everybody marveled at his broad grasp of the country and knowledge of its conditions. Of course, they said the wife was a brick, and only a few wise ones appreciated and pitied the brave little woman. She did the work. He got the credit and reward. In the Northwest Territory, a married woman cannot stake or record a creek, bench, or quartz claim. So Edwin Bentham went down to the Gold Commissioner and filed on Bench Claim 23, second tier of French Hill. And when April came, they were washing out $1,000 a day, with many, many such days in prospect. At the base of French Hill lay El Dorado Creek, and on a creek claim stood the cabin of Clyde Wharton. At present he was not washing out a diurnal $1,000, but his dumps grew, shift by shift, and there would come a time when those dumps would pass through his sluice boxes, depositing in the riffles in the course of half a dozen days several $100,000. He often sat in that cabin, smoked his pipe, and dreamed beautiful little dreams, dreams in which neither the dumps nor the half-ton of dust in the PC Company's big safe played a part. And Grace Bentham, as she washed tin dishes in her hillside cabin, often glanced down into El Dorado Creek and dreamed, not of dumps nor dust, however. They met frequently as the trail to the one claim crossed the other, and there is much to talk about in the Northland Spring, but never once by the light of an eye nor the slip of a tongue did they speak their hearts. This is as it was at first. But one day Edwin Bentham was brutal. All the boys are thus. Besides being a French Hill king now, he began to think a great deal of himself and to forget all he owed to his wife. On this day Wharton heard of it, and waylaid Grace Bentham and talked wildly. This made her very happy, though she would not listen, and made him promise to not say such things again. Her hour had not come. But the sun swept back on its northern journey. The black of midnight changed to the steely color of dawn. The snow slipped away. The water dashed again over the glacial drift, and the wash-up began. Day and night the yellow clay and scraped bedrock hurried through the swift sluices, yielding up its ransom to the strong men from the southland. And in that time of tumult came Grace Bentham's hour. To all of us such hours at some time come, that is, to us who are not too phlegmatic. Some people are good, not from inherent love of virtue, but from sheer laziness. but those of us who know weak moments may understand. Edwin Bentham was weighing dust over the bar of the saloon at the Forks. Altogether too much of his dust went over that pine board, when his wife came down the hill and slipped into Clyde Wharton's cabin. Wharton was not expecting her, but that did not alter the case, and much subsequent misery and idle waiting might have been avoided had not Father Roubeau seen this and turned aside from the main creek trail. My child.
Hold now, Father Roubeau. Though I'm not of your faith, I respect you. But you can't come in between this woman and me.
You know what you are doing?
No. Were you God Almighty ready to fling me into eternal fire? I'd bank my will against yours in this matter.
Wharton had placed Grace on a stool and stood belligerently before her.
You sit down on that chair and keep quiet, he continued, addressing the Jesuit. I'll take my innings now. You can have yours after.
Father Roubeau bowed courteously and obeyed. He was an easygoing man and had learned to bide his time. Wharton pulled a stool alongside the woman's, smothering her hand in his.
Then you do care for me and will take me away?
Her face seemed to reflect the peace of this man, against whom she might draw close for shelter.
Dear, don't you remember what I said before? Of course I...
But how can you? The wash-up.
Do you think that worries? Anyway, I'll give the job to Father Roubeau here. I can trust him to safely bank the dust with the company.
To think of it, I'll never see him again.
A blessing?
And to go... Oh, Clyde, I can't.
There, there. Of course you can. Just let me plan it. You see, as soon as we get a few traps together, we'll start and...
Suppose he comes back?
I'll break every...
No fighting, Clyde. Promise me that.
All right, just tell the men to throw him off the claim. They've seen how he's treated you and haven't much love for him.
You mustn't do that. You mustn't hurt him.
What then? Let him come right in here and take you away before my eyes?
No,
she half-whispered, stroking his hand softly.
Then let me run it and don't worry. I'll see he doesn't get hurt. Precious lot he cared whether you got hurt or not. We won't go back to Dawson. I'll send word down for a couple of the boys to outfit and pole a boat up the Yukon. We'll cross the divide and raft down the Indian River to meet them. Then?
And then?
Her head was on his shoulder. Their voices sank to softer cadences, each word a caress. The Jesuit fidgeted nervously.
And then?
She repeated.
Why, we'll pole up, and up and up, and portage to the White Horse Rapids and the Box Canyon.
Yes?
And the 60-mile River. Then the lakes, Chilkoot, Dia, and Saltwater.
But, dear, I can't pole a boat.
You little goose, I'll get Sitka Charlie. He knows all the good water and best camps, and he is the best traveler I ever met, if he's an Indian. All you have to do is to sit in the middle of the boat and sing songs and play Cleopatra and fight. No, we're in luck. Too early for mosquitoes.
And then, oh my Anthony.
And then a steamer, San Francisco and the world. Never to come back to this cursed hole again. Think of it. The world and ours to choose from. I'll sell out. Why, we're rich.
The Walworth Syndicate will give me $500,000 for what's left in the ground, and I've got twice as much in the dumps and with the PC Company. We'll go to the fair in Paris in 1900. We'll go to Jerusalem, if you say so. We'll buy an Italian palace, and you can play Cleopatra to your heart's content. No, you shall be Lucretia, Acte, or anybody your little heart sees fit to become. But you mustn't. You really mustn't.
The wife of Caesar shall be above reproach.
Of course, but...
But I won't be your wife, will I, dear?
I didn't mean that.
But you'll love me just as much and never even think. Oh, I know you'll be like other men. You'll grow tired and...
How can you? I...
Promise me?
Yes, yes, I do promise.
You say it so easily, dear, but how do you know? Or I know. I have so little to give, yet it is so much, and all I have. Oh, Clyde, promise me you won't.
There, there, you mustn't begin to doubt already. Till death do us part, you know.
Think, I once said that to him, and now...
And now, little sweetheart, you're not to bother about such things any more.
Of course, I never will, and...
And for the first time, lips trembled against lips. Father Roubeau had been watching the main trail through the window, but could stand the strain no longer. He cleared his throat and turned around.
Your turn now, Father.
Wharton's face was flushed with the fire of his first embrace. There was an exultant ring to his voice as he abdicated in the other's favor. He had no doubt as to the result, neither had Grace, for a smile played about her mouth as she faced the priest.
"My child," he began, "my heart bleeds for you. It is a pretty dream, but it cannot be."
"And why, father? I've said yes."
"You knew not what you did. You did not think of the oath you took before your God to that man who is your husband. It remains for me to make you realize the sanctity of such a pledge."
"And if I do realize and yet refuse?"
"Then God."
"Which God? My husband has a God which I care not to worship. There must be many such."
"Child, unsay those words. Ah, you do not mean them. I understand. I, too, have had such moments."
For an instant, he was back in his native France, and a wistful, sad-eyed face came as a mist between him and the woman before him.
"Then, father, has my God forsaken me? I am not wicked above women. My misery with him has been great. Why should it be greater? Why shall I not grasp at happiness? I cannot, will not go back to him."
"Rather is your God forsaken. Return. Throw your burden upon him, and the darkness shall be lifted, O my child."
"No, it is useless. I've made my bed, and so shall I lie. I will go on, and if God punishes me, I shall bear it somehow. You do not understand. You are not a woman."
"My mother was a woman."
"But..."
"And Christ was born of a woman."
She did not answer. A silence fell. Wharton pulled his mustache impatiently and kept an eye on the trail. Grace leaned her elbow on the table, her face set with resolve. The smile had died away. Father Rabot shifted his ground.
"You have children?"
"At one time I wished, but now, no. And I am thankful."
"And a mother?"
"Yes."
"She loves you?"
"Yes."
Her replies were whispers.
"And a brother?"
"No matter, he is a man. But a sister?" Her head drooped a quavering yes.
"Younger? Very much?"
7 years.
"And you have thought well about this matter? About them? About your mother and your sister? She stands on the threshold of her woman's life, and this wildness of yours may mean much to her. Could you go before her, look upon her fresh young face, hold her hand in yours, or touch your cheek to hers?"
To his words, her brain formed vivid images, till she cried out,
"Don't! Don't!"
and shrank away as do the wolf dogs from the lash.
"But you must face all this, and better it is to do it now."
In his eyes, which she could not see, there was a great compassion. But his face, tense and quivering, showed no relenting. She raised her head from the table, forced back the tears, struggled for control.
"I shall go away. They will never see me, and come to forget me. I shall be to them as dead, and I will go with Clyde today."
It seemed final. Wharton stepped forward, but the priest waved him back.
"You have wished for children,"
a silent yes,
"and prayed for them."
"Often."
"And have you thought if you should have children?"
Father Rabot's eyes rested for a moment on the man by the window. A quick light shot across her face. Then the full import dawned upon her. She raised her hand appealingly, but he went on.
"Can you picture an innocent babe in your arms? A boy. The world is not so hard upon a girl. Why, your very breast would turn to gall. And you could be proud and happy of your boy as you looked on other children?"
"Oh, have pity. Hush."
"A scapegoat."
Don't, I will go back."
She was at his feet.
"A child to grow up with no thought of evil, and one day the world to fling a tender name in his face? A child to look back and curse you from whose loins he sprang?"
"Oh, my God, my God."
She groveled on the floor. The priest sighed and raised her to her feet. Wharton pressed forward, but she motioned him back.
"Don't come near me, Clyde. I'm going back."
The tears were coursing pitifully down her face, but she made no effort to wipe them away.
"After all this, you cannot. I will not let you."
"Don't touch me."
She shivered and drew back.
"I will. You are mine, do you hear? You are mine."
Then he whirled upon the priest.
"Oh, what a fool I was to ever let you wag your silly tongue. Thank your God you are not a common man, for I'd... But the priestly prerogative must be exercised, eh? Well, you have exercised it. Now get out of my house, or I'll forget who and what you are."
Father Rabot bowed, took her hand, and started for the door. But Wharton cut them off.
"Grace, you said you loved me."
"I did."
"And do you now?"
"I do."
"Say it again."
"I do love you, Clyde, I do."
"There, you priest," he cried. "You have heard it.
And with those words on her lips, you would send her back to live a lie in a hell with that man?
But Father Ribault whisked the woman into the inner room and closed the door.
No words, he whispered to Wharton as he struck a casual posture on a stool. Remember, for her sake, he added.
The room echoed to a rough knock at the door. The latch raised and Edwin Bentham stepped in.
Seen anything of my wife? He asked as soon as salutations had been exchanged.
Two heads nodded negatively.
I saw her tracks down from the cabin, he continued tentatively, and they broke off just opposite here on the main trail.
His listeners looked bored.
And I thought...
She was here,
thundered Wharton. The priest silenced him with a look.
Did you see her tracks leading up to this cabin, my son?
Wily Father Ribault, he had taken good care to obliterate them as he came up the same path an hour before.
I didn't stop to look.
His eyes rested suspiciously on the door to the other room, then interrogated the priest. The latter shook his head, but the doubt seemed to linger. Father Ribault breathed a swift, silent prayer and rose to his feet.
If you doubt me, why?
He made as though to open the door. A priest could not lie. Edwin Bentham had heard this often and believed it.
Of course not, Father, he interposed hurriedly. I was only wondering where my wife had gone and thought maybe... I guess she's up at Mrs. Stanton's on French Gulch. Nice weather, isn't it? Heard the news? Flowers going down to $40 a hundred, and they say the Chechaquas are flocking down the river in droves. But I must be going, so goodbye.
The door slammed, and from the window they watched him take his guest up French Gulch. A few weeks later, just after the June high water, two men shot a canoe into midstream and made fast to a derelict pine. This tightened the painter and jerked the frail craft along as would a towboat. Father Ribault had been directed to leave the upper country and return to his swarthy children at Minook. The white men had come among them, and they were devoting too little time to fishing and too much to a certain deity whose transient habitat was in countless black bottles. Malamute Kid also had business in the lower country, so they journeyed together. But one in all the Northland knew the name Paul Ribault, and that man was Malamute Kid. Before him alone did the priest cast off the sacerdotal garb and stand naked. And why not? These two men knew each other. Had they not shared the last morsel of fish, the last pinch of tobacco, the last and inmost thought on the barren stretches of Bering Sea and the heartbreaking mazes of the Great Delta, on the terrible winter journey from Point Barrow to the Porcupine? Father Ribault puffed heavily at his trail-worn pipe and gazed on the red-disked sun poised somberly on the edge of the northern horizon. Malamute Kid wound up his watch. It was midnight.
Cheer up, old man.
The kid was evidently gathering up a broken thread.
God surely will forgive such a lie. Let me give you the word of a man who strikes a true note. If she have spoken a word, remember thy lips are sealed, and the brand of the dog is upon him by whom is the secret revealed. If there be trouble to hear word and alive, the blackest can clear, lie, while thy lips can move or a man is alive to hear.
Father Ribault removed his pipe and reflected.
The man speaks truth, but my soul is not vexed with that. The lie and the penance stand with God, but...
What then? Your hands are clean.
Not so, kid. I've thought much, and yet the thing remains. I know and made her go back.
The clear note of a robin rang out from the wooden bank. A partridge drummed the call in the distance. A moose lunged noisily in the eddy. But the twain smoked on in silence. End of section 6. Section 7 of The Son of the Wolf by Jack London. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Ben Tucker. The Wisdom of the Trail. Sitka Charlie had achieved the impossible. Other Indians might have known as much of the wisdom of the trail as he did, but he alone knew the white man's wisdom, the honor of the trail, and the law. But these things had not come to him in a day. The aboriginal mind is slow to generalize, and many facts, repeated often, are required to compass an understanding. Sitka Charlie, from boyhood, had been thrown continually with white men, and as a man he had elected to cast his fortunes with them, expatriating himself once and for all from his own people. Even then, respecting, almost venerating their power and pondering over it, he had yet to divine its secret essence, the honor and the law. and it was only by the cumulative evidence of years that he had finally come to understand. Being an alien, when he did know, he knew it better than the white man himself. Being an Indian, he had achieved the impossible. And of these things had been bred a certain contempt for his own people, a contempt which he had made it a custom to conceal, but which now burst forth in a polyglot whirlwind of curses upon the heads of Kachukta and Gauhi. They cringed before him like a brace of snarling wolf-dogs, too cowardly to spring, too wolfish to cover their fangs. They were not handsome creatures. Neither was Sitka Charlie. All three were frightful-looking. There was no flesh to their faces. Their cheekbones were masked with hideous scabs, which had cracked and frozen alternately under the intense frost. While their eyes burned luridly with the light which is born of desperation and hunger. Men so situated beyond the pale of the honor and the law are not to be trusted. Sitka Charlie knew this, and this was why he had forced them to abandon their rifles with the rest of the camp outfit 10 days before. His rifle and Captain Eppingwell's were the only ones that remained.
"Come and get a fire started,"
he commanded, drawing out the precious matchbox with its attendant strips of dry birch bark. The two Indians fell sullenly to the task of gathering dead branches and underwood. They were weak and paused often, catching themselves in the act of stooping, with giddy motions, or staggering to the center of operations, with their knees shaking like castanets. After each trip they rested for a moment, as though sick and deadly weary. At times their eyes took on the patient stoicism of dumb suffering, and again the ego seemed almost burst forth with its wild cry,
I want to exist.
The dominant note of the whole living universe. A light breath of air blew from the south, nipping the exposed portions of their bodies, and driving the frost in needles of fire through fur and flesh to the bones. So, when the fire had grown lusty and thawed a damp circle in the snow about it, Sitka Charlie forced his reluctant comrades to lend a hand in pitching a fly. It was a primitive affair, merely a blanket stretched parallel with the fire and to windward of it, at an angle of perhaps 45 degrees. This shut out the chill wind and threw the heat backward and down upon those who were to huddle in its shelter. Then a layer of green spruce boughs were spread, that their bodies might not come in contact with the snow. When this task was completed, Kachukta and Gauhi proceeded to take care of their feet. Their ice-bound moccasins were sadly worn by much travel, and the sharp ice of the river jams had cut them to rags. Their Siwash socks were similarly conditioned, and when these had been thawed and removed, the dead white tips of the toes, in the various stages of mortification, told their simple tale of the trail. Leaving the two to the drying of their footgear, Sitka Charlie turned back over the course he had come. He, too, had a mighty longing to sit by the fire and tend his complaining flesh, but the honor and the law forbade. He toiled painfully over the frozen field, each step a protest, every muscle in revolt. Several times, where the open water between the jams had recently crusted, he was forced to miserably accelerate his movements as the fragile footing swayed and threatened beneath him. In such places death was quick and easy, but it was not his desire to endure no more. His deepening anxiety vanished as two Indians dragged into view round a bend in the river. They staggered and panted like men under heavy burdens, yet the packs on their backs were a matter of but a few pounds. He questioned them eagerly, and their replies seemed to relieve him. He hurried on. Next came two white men, supporting between them a woman. They also behaved as though drunken, and their limbs shook with weakness. But the woman leaned lightly upon them, choosing to carry herself forward with her own strength. At the sight of her, a flash of joy cast its fleeting light across Sitka Charlie's face. He cherished a very great regard for Mrs. Eppingwell. He had seen many white women, but this was the first to travel the trail with him. When Captain Eppingwell proposed the hazardous undertaking and made him an offer for his services, he had shaken his head gravely, for it was an unknown journey through the dismal vastnesses of the Northland, and he knew it to be of the kind that try to the uttermost the souls of men. But when he learned that the captain's wife was to accompany them, he had refused flatly to have anything further to do with it. Had it been a woman of his own race, he would have harbored no objections. But these women of the Southland, no, they were too soft, too tender for such enterprises. Sitka Charlie did not know this kind of woman. 5 minutes before, he did not even dream of taking charge of the expedition. But when she came to him with her wonderful smile and her straight, clean English, and talked to the point without pleading or persuading, he had incontinently yielded. Had there been a softness and appeal to mercy in the eyes, a tremble to the voice, a taking advantage of sex, he would have stiffened to steel. Instead, her clear, searching eyes and clear, ringing voice, her utter frankness and tacit assumption of equality, had robbed him of his reason. He felt, then, that this was a new breed of woman, and ere they had been trailmates for many days, he knew why the sons of such women mastered the land and the sea, and why the sons of his own womankind could not prevail against them. Tender and soft, day after day he watched her, muscle-weary, exhausted, indomitable, and the words beat in upon him a perennial refrain. Tender and soft. He knew her feet had been borne to easy paths and sunny lands, strangers to the moccasined pain of the north, unkissed by the chill lips of the frost, and he watched and marveled at them, twinkling ever through the weary day. She had always a smile and a word of cheer, from which not even the meanest packer was excluded. As the way grew darker, she seemed to stiffen and gather greater strength, and when Kachukta and Gauhi, who had bragged that they knew every landmark of the way as a child did the skin bales of the teepee, acknowledged that they knew not where they were, it was she who raised a forgiving voice amid the curses of the men. She had sung to them that night till they felt the weariness fall from them and were ready to face the future with fresh hope. And when the food failed and each scant stint was measured jealously, she it was who rebelled against the machinations of her husband and Sitka Charlie, and demanded and received a share neither greater nor less than that of the others. Sitka Charlie was proud to know this woman. A new richness, a greater breath, had come into his life with her presence. Hitherto he had been his own mentor, had turned to right or left at no man's beck. He had molded himself according to his own dictates, nourished his manhood regardless of all save his own opinion. For the first time he had felt a call from without for the best that was in him, just a glance of appreciation from the clear searching eyes, a word of thanks from the clear ringing voice, just a slight wreathing of the lips in the wonderful smile, and he walked with the gods for hours to come. It was a new stimulant to his manhood. For the first time he thrilled with a conscious pride in his wisdom of the trail, and between the twain they ever lifted the sinking hearts of their comrades. The faces of the two men and the woman brightened as they saw him, for after all he was the staff they leaned upon. But Sitka Charlie, rigid as was his wont, concealing pain and pleasure impartially beneath an iron exterior, asked them the welfare of the rest, told the distance to the fire, and continued on the back trip. Next he met a single Indian, unburdened, limping, lips compressed, and eyes set with the pain of a foot in which the quick fought a losing battle with the dead. All possible care had been taken of him, but in the last extremity the weak and unfortunate must perish, and Sitka Charlie deemed his days to be few. The man could not keep up for long, so he gave him rough, cheering words. After that came two more Indians, to whom he had allotted the task of helping along Joe, the third white man of the party. They had deserted him. Sitka Charlie saw at a glance the lurking spring in their bodies, and knew they had at last cast off his mastery. So he was not taken unawares when he ordered them back in quest of their abandoned charge, and saw the gleam of the hunting knives that they drew from the sheaths. A pitiful spectacle, three weak men lifting their puny strength in the face of the mighty vastness. But the two recoiled under the fierce rifle blows of the one, and returned like beaten dogs to the leash. 2 hours later, with Joe reeling between them and Sitka Charlie bringing up the rear, they came to the fire, where the remainder of the expedition crouched in the shelter of the fly. "A few words, my comrades, before we sleep," Sitka Charlie said after they had devoured their slim rations of unleavened bread. He was speaking to the Indians in their own tongue, having already given the import to the whites. "A few words, my comrades, for your own good, that ye may yet perchance live. I shall give you the law, on his own head by the death of him that breaks it. We have passed the hills of silence, and we now travel the head reaches of the Stuart. It may be one sleep, it may be several, it may be many sleeps, but in time we shall come among the men of the Yukon, who have much grub. It were well that we look to the law. Today Kachukta and Gauhi, whom I commanded to break trail, forgot they were men, and like frightened children ran away. True, they forgot, so let us forget. But hereafter let them remember. If it should happen they do not..." He touched his rifle carelessly, grimly. "Tomorrow they shall carry the flower,
and see that the white man Joe lies not down by the trail. The cups of flour are counted, should so much as an ounce be wanting at nightfall. Do ye understand? Today there were others that forgot. Moosehead and three salmon left the white man Joe to lie in the snow. Let them forget no more. With the light of day shall they go forth and break trail. Ye have heard the law. Look well, lest ye break it.
Sitka Charlie found it beyond him to keep the line close up. From Moosehead and three salmon who broke trail in advance, to Ka Chukta and Gauhi and Joe, it straggled out over a mile. Each staggered, fell, or rested as he saw fit. The line of march was a progression through a chain of irregular halts. Each drew upon the last remnant of his strength and stumbled onward till it was expended. But, in some miraculous way, there was always another last remnant. Each time a man fell, it was with the firm belief that he would rise no more. Yet he did rise, and again and again. The flesh yielded, the will conquered. But each triumph was a tragedy. The Indian with the frozen foot, no longer erect, crawled forward on hand and knee. He rarely rested, for he knew the penalty exacted by the frost. Even Mrs. Eppingwell's lips were at last set in a stony smile, and her eyes, seeing, saw not. Often she stopped, pressing a mittened hand to her heart, gasping and dizzy. Joe, the white man, had passed beyond the stage of suffering. He no longer begged to be let alone, prayed to die, but was soothed and content under the anodyne of delirium. Ka Chukta and Gauhi dragged him on roughly, venting upon him many a savage glance or blow. To them it was the acme of injustice. Their hearts were bitter with hate, heavy with fear. Why should they cumber their strength with his weakness? To do so meant death, not to do so. And they remembered the law of Sitka Charlie and the rifle. Joe fell with greater frequency as the daylight waned, and so hard was he to raise that they dropped farther and farther behind. Sometimes all three pitched into the snow, so weak had the Indians become. Yet on their backs was life and strength and warmth. Within the flour sacks were all the potentialities of existence. They could not but think of this, and it was not strange that which came to pass. They had fallen by the side of a great timber jam where 1,000 cords of firewood waited the match. Nearby was an air hole through the ice. Ka Chukta looked on the wood and the water, as did Gauhi. Then they looked at each other. Never a word was spoken. Gauhi struck a fire. Ka Chukta filled a tin cup with water and heated it. Joe babbled of things in another land in a tongue they did not understand. They mixed flour with the warm water till it was a thin paste, and of this they drank many cups. They did not offer any to Joe, but he did not mind. He did not mind anything, not even his moccasins, which scorched and smoked among the coals. A crystal mist of snow fell about them, softly, caressingly, wrapping them in clinging robes of white, and their feet would have yet trod many trails had not destiny brushed the clouds aside and cleared the air. Nay, 10 minutes' delay would have been salvation. Sitka Charlie, looking back, saw the pillared smoke of their fire and guessed. And he looked ahead at those who were faithful, and at Mrs. Eppingwell.
"So, my good comrades, ye have again forgotten that you were men. Good, very good. There will be fewer bellies to feed."
Sitka Charlie retied the flour as he spoke, strapping the pack to the one on his own back. He kicked Joe till the pain broke through the poor devil's bliss and brought him doddering to his feet. Then he shoved him out upon the trail and started him on his way. The two Indians attempted to slip off.
"Hold, Gauhi! And thou too, Ka Chukta! Hath the flower given such strength to thy legs that they may outrun the swift-winged lead? Think not to cheat the law. Be men for the last time, and be content that ye die full-stomached. Come, step up, back to the timber, shoulder to shoulder. Come!"
The two men obeyed quietly without fear, for it is the future which pressed upon the man, not the present.
"Thou, Gauhi, hast a wife and children, and a deer-skin lodge in the Chippewan. What is thy will in the matter?"
"Give thou her of the goods which are mine by the word of the captain, the blankets, the beads, the tobacco, the box which makes strange sounds after the manner of the white men. Say that I did die on the trail, but say not how."
"And thou, Ka Chukta, who hast nor wife nor child?"
"Mine is a sister, the wife of the factor at Koshim. He beats her, and she is not happy. Give thou her the goods which are mine by the contract, and tell her it were well she go back to her own people. Shouldst thou meet the man, and be so minded, it were a good deed that he should die. He beats her, and she is afraid."
"Are ye content to die by the law?"
"We are,
Then goodbye, my good comrades. May ye sit by the well-filled pot in warm lodges ere the day is done. As he spoke, he raised his rifle, and many echoes broke the silence. Hardly had they died away when other rifles spoke in the distance. Sitka Charlie started. There had been more than one shot, yet there was but one other rifle in the party. He gave a fleeting glance at the men who lay so quietly, smiled viciously at the wisdom of the trail, and hurried on to meet the men of the Yukon. End of section 7. Section 8 of The Son of the Wolf by Jack London. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Ben Tucker. The Wife of a King. Once when the Northland was very young, the social and civic virtues were remarkably alike for their paucity and their simplicity. When the burden of domestic duties grew grievous, and the fireside mood expanded to a constant protest against its bleak loneliness, the adventurers from the Southland, in lieu of better, paid the stipulated prices and took unto themselves native wives. It was a foretaste of paradise to the women, for it must be confessed that the white rovers gave far better care and treatment of them than did their Indian co-partners. Of course, the white men themselves were satisfied with such deals, as were also the Indian men for that matter, having sold their daughters and sisters for cotton blankets and obsolete rifles, and traded their warm furs for flimsy calico and bad whiskey. The sons of the soil promptly and cheerfully succumbed to quick consumption and other swift diseases correlated with the blessings of a superior civilization. It was in these days of Arcadian simplicity that Cal Galbraith journeyed through the land and fell sick on the lower river. It was a refreshing advent in the lives of the good sisters of the Holy Cross, who gave him shelter and medicine, though they little dreamed of the hot elixir infused into his veins by the touch of their soft hands and their gentle ministrations. Cal Galbraith became troubled with strange thoughts which clamored for attention till he laid eyes on the mission girl, Madeline. Yet he gave no sign, biding his time patiently. He strengthened with the coming spring, and when the sun rode the heavens in a golden circle, and the joy and throb of life was in all the land, he gathered his still weak body together and departed. Now, Madeline, the mission girl, was an orphan. Her white father had failed to give a bald-faced grizzly the trail one day, and had died quickly. Then her Indian mother, having no man to fill the winter cache, had tried the hazardous experiment of waiting till the salmon run on 50 pounds of flour and half as many of bacon. After that, the baby, Chukra, went to live with the good sisters, and to be thenceforth known by another name. But Madeline still had kinsfolk, the nearest being a dissolute uncle who outraged his vitals with inordinate quantities of the white man's whiskey. He strove daily to walk with the gods, and incidentally, his feet sought shorter trails to the grave. When sober, he suffered exquisite torture. He had no conscience. To this ancient vagabond, Cal Galbraith duly presented himself, and they consumed many words and much tobacco in the conversation that followed. Promises were also made, and in the end the old heathen took a few pounds of dried salmon in his birch-bark canoe and paddled away to the mission of the Holy Cross. It is not given the world to know what promises he made and what lies he told. The sisters never gossip. But when he returned, upon his swarthy chest there was a brass crucifix, and in his canoe his niece Madeline. That night there was a grand wedding and a potlatch, so that for 2 days to follow there was no fishing done by the village. But in the morning Madeline shook the dust of the lower river from her moccasins, and with her husband in a poling boat went to live on the upper river in a place known as the Lower Country. And in the years which followed, she was a good wife, sharing her husband's hardships and cooking his food, and she kept him in straight trails till he learned to save his dust and to work mightily. In the end he struck it rich and built a cabin in Circle City, and his happiness was such that men who came to visit him in his home circle became restless at the sight of it and envied him greatly. But the Northland began to mature in social amenities to make their appearance. Hitherto the Southland had sent forth its sons, but it now belched forth a new exodus, this time of its daughters. Sisters and wives they were not, but they did not fail to put new ideas in the heads of the men, and to elevate the tone of things in ways peculiarly their own. No more did the squaws gather at the dances, go roaring down the center in the good old Virginia reels, or make merry with jolly Dan Tucker. They fell back on their natural stoicism and uncomplainingly watched the rule of their white sisters from their cabins.
Then another exodus came over the mountains from the prolific Southland. This time it was of women that became mighty in the land. Their word was law. Their law was steel. They frowned upon the Indian wives, while the other women became mild and walked humbly. They were cowards who became ashamed of their ancient covenants with the daughters of the soil, who looked with a new distaste upon their dark-skinned children. But there were also others, men, who remained true and proud of their aboriginal vows. When it became the fashion to divorce the native wives, Cal Galbraith retained his manhood, and in doing so felt the heavy hand of the women who had come last, knew least, but who ruled the land. One day the upper country, which lies far above Circle City, was pronounced rich. Dog teams carried the news to Saltwater. Golden argosies freighted the lure across the North Pacific. Wires and cables sang with the tidings, and the world heard for the first time of the Klondike River and the Yukon country. Cal Galbraith had lived the years quietly. He had been a good husband to Madeline, and she had blessed him. But somehow discontent fell upon him. He felt vague yearnings for his own kind, for the life he had been shut out from. A general sort of desire which men sometimes feel, to break out and taste the prime of living. Besides, there drifted down the river wild rumors of the wonderful El Dorado, glowing descriptions of the city of logs and tents, and ludicrous accounts of the Chechaquas, who had rushed in and were stampeding the whole country. Circle City was dead. The world had moved on upriver and become a new and most marvelous world. Cal Galbraith grew restless on the edge of things, and wished to see with his own eyes. So, after the wash-up, he weighed in a couple of 100 pounds of dust on the company's big scales, and took a draft for the same on Dawson. Then he put Tom Dixon in charge of his mines, kissed Madeline goodbye, promised to be back before the first mush ice ran, and took passage on an upriver steamer. Madeline waited through all the 3 months of daylight. She fed the dogs, gave much of her time to young Cal, watched the short summer fade away and the sun began its long journey to the south, and she prayed much in the manner of the Sisters of the Holy Cross. The fall came, and with it there was mush ice on the Yukon, and Circle City kings returning to the winter's work at their mines. But no Cal Galbraith. Tom Dixon received a letter, however, for his men sledded up her winter's supply of dry pine. The company received a letter, for its dog teams filled her cache with their best provisions, and she was told that her credit was limitless. Through all the ages man has been held the chief instigator of the woes of woman. But in this case the men held their tongues and swore harshly at one of their number who was away, while the woman failed utterly to emulate them. So, without needless delay, Madeline heard strange tales of Cal Galbraith's doings, also of a certain Greek dancer, who played with men as children did with bubbles. Now, Madeline was an Indian woman, and further, she had no woman friend to whom to go for wise counsel. She prayed and planned by turns, and that night, being quick of resolve and action, she harnessed the dogs, and with young Cal securely lashed to the sled, stole away. Though the Yukon still ran free, the eddy ice was growing, and each day saw the river dwindling to a slushy thread. Save him who has done the like, no man knows what she endured in traveling 100 miles on the rim ice, nor may they understand the toil and hardship of breaking the 200 miles of packed ice which remained after the river froze for good. But Madeline was an Indian woman, so she did these things, and one night there came a knock at Malamute Kid's door. Thereat he fed a team of starving dogs, put a healthy youngster to bed, and turned his attention to an exhausted woman. He removed her ice-bound moccasins while he listened to her tale, and stuck the point of his knife into her feet, that he might see how far they were frozen. Despite his tremendous virility, Malamute Kid was possessed of a softer, womanly element, which could win the confidence of a snarling wolf-dog, or draw confessions from the most wintry heart. Nor did he seek them. Hearts opened to him as spontaneously as flowers to the sun. Even the priest, Father Roubaud, had been known to confess to him, while the men and women of the Northland were ever knocking at his door, a door from which the latch string hung always out. To Madeline he could do no wrong, make no mistake. She had known him from the time she first cast her lot among the people of her father's race, and to her half-barbaric mind it seemed that in him was centered the wisdom of the ages, that between his vision and the future there could be no intervening veil. There were false ideals in the land. The social strictures of Dawson were not synonymous with those of the previous era, and the swift maturity of the Northland involved much wrong. Malamute Kid was aware of this, and he had Cal Galbraith's measure accurately. He knew a hasty word was the father of much evil. Besides, he was minded to teach a great lesson and bring shame upon the man. So Stanley Prince, the young mining expert, was called into the conference the following night, as was also Lucky Jack Harrington and his violin. That same night, Bettles, who owed a great debt to Malamute Kid, harnessed up Cal Galbraith's dogs, lashed Cal Galbraith Jr. to the sled, and slipped away in the dark for Stewart River. 2.
So, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, now reverse. No, no, start up again, Jack. See, this way.
Prince executed the movement as one should who had led the cotillion.
Now, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, reverse. Ah, that's better. Try it again. I say, you know, you mustn't look at your feet. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Shorter steps. You're not hanging to the G-pole just now. Try it over. There, that's the way. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3.
Round and round went Prince and Madeline in an interminable waltz. The table and stools had been shoved over against the wall to increase the room. Malamute Kid sat on the bunk, chin to knees, greatly interested. Jack Harrington sat beside him, scraping away on his violin and following the dancers. It was a unique situation, the undertaking of these three men with the woman. The most pathetic part, perhaps, was the businesslike way in which they went about it. No athlete was ever trained more rigidly for a coming contest, nor wolf-dog for the harness than was she. But they had good material, for Madeline, unlike most women of her race, in her childhood had escaped the carrying of heavy burdens and the toil of the trail. Besides, she was a clean-limbed, willowy creature, possessed of much grace which had not hitherto been realized. It was this grace which the men strove to bring out and knock into shape.
"Trouble with her, she learned to dance all wrong,"
Prince remarked to the bunk after having deposited his breathless pupil on the table.
"She's quick at picking up, yet I could do better had she never danced a step. But, say, kid, I can't understand this."
Prince imitated a peculiar movement of the shoulders and head, a weakness Madeline suffered from in walking.
"Lucky for her, she was raised in the mission," Malamute Kid answered. "Packing, you know, the head strap. Other Indian women have it bad, but she didn't do any packing till after she married, and then only at first saw hard lines with that husband of hers. They went through the 40-mile famine together."
"But can we break it?"
"Don't know. Perhaps long walks with her trainers will make the riffle. Anyway, they'll take it out some, won't they, Madeline?"
The girl nodded assent. If Malamute Kid, who knew all things, said so, why, it was so. That was all there was to it. She had come over to them, anxious to begin again. Harrington surveyed her in quest of her points much in the same manner men usually do horses. It certainly was not disappointing, for he asked with sudden interest,
"What did that beggarly uncle of yours get, anyway?"
"One rifle, one blanket, 20 bottles of hooch. Rifle broke."
She said this last scornfully, as though disgusted at how low her maiden value had been rated. She spoke fair English, with many peculiarities of her husband's speech, but there was still perceptible the Indian accent, the traditional groping after strange gutturals. Even this her instructors had taken in hand, and with no small success, too. At the next intermission, Prince discovered a new predicament.
"I say, kid," he said, "we're wrong, all wrong. She can't learn in moccasins. Put her feet into slippers, and then onto that waxed floor."
"Phew!"
Madeline raised a foot and regarded her shapeless house moccasins dubiously. In previous winters, both at Circle City and at 40 Mile, she had danced many a night away with similar footgear, and there had been nothing the matter. But now, well, if there was anything wrong, it was for Malamute Kid to know, not her. But Malamute Kid did know, and he had a good eye for measures. So he put on his cap and mittens and went down the hill to pay Mrs. Eppingwell a call. Her husband, Clove Eppingwell, was prominent in the community as one of the great government officials. The kid had noted her slender little foot one night at the governor's ball. And as he also knew her to be as sensible as she was pretty, it was no task to ask of her a certain small favor. On his return, Madeline withdrew for a moment to the inner room. When she reappeared, Prince was startled.
"By Jove," he gasped. "Who'd have thought it? A little witch? Why, my sister."
"Is an English girl," interrupted Malamute Kid, "with an English foot. This girl comes of a small-footed race. Moccasins just broadened her feet healthily, while she did not misshape them by running with the dogs in her childhood."
But this explanation failed utterly to allay Prince's admiration. Harrington's commercial instinct was touched, and as he looked upon the exquisitely turned foot and ankle, there ran through his mind the sordid list. 1 rifle, 1 blanket, 20 bottles of hooch. Madeline was the wife of a king, a king whose yellow treasure could buy outright a score of fashion's puppets. Yet, in all her life, her feet had known no gear save red-tanned moose hide. At first she had looked in awe at the tiny white satin slippers, but she had quickly understood the admiration which shone manlike in the eyes of the men. Her face flushed with pride. For the moment, she was drunken with her woman's loveliness. Then she murmured with increased scorn. "And one rifle broke." So the training went on. Every day Malamute Kid led the girl out on long walks devoted to the correction of her carriage and the shortening of her stride. There was little likelihood of her identity being discovered, for Cal Galbraith and the rest of the old-timers were like lost children among the many strangers who had rushed into the land. Besides, the frost of the north has a bitter tongue, and the tender women of the south, to shield their cheeks from its bitter caresses, were prone to the use of canvas masks. With faces obscured and bodies lost in squirrel-skin parkas, a mother and daughter meeting on trail would pass as strangers. The coaching progressed rapidly. At first it had been slowed, but later a sudden acceleration had manifested itself. This began from the moment Madeline tried on the white satin slippers, and in so doing found herself. The pride of her renegade father, apart from any natural self-esteem she might possess, at that instant received its birth. Hitherto she had deemed herself a woman of an alien breed, of inferior stock, purchased by her lord's favor. Her husband had seemed to her a god, who had lifted her, through no essential virtues on her part, to his own godlike level. But she had never forgotten, even when young Cal was born, that she was not of his people. As she had been a god, so had his womenkind been goddesses. She might have contrasted herself with them, but she had never compared. It might have been that familiarity bred contempt. However, be that as it may, she had ultimately come to understand these roving white men and to weigh them. True, her mind was dark to deliberate analysis, but she yet possessed her womanly clarity of vision in such matters. On the night of the slipper, she had measured the bold, open admiration of her three man-friends, and for the first time comparison had suggested itself. It was only a foot and an ankle, but comparison could not, in the nature of things, cease at that point. She judged herself by their standards till the divinity of her white sisters was shattered. After all, they were only women, and why should she not exalt herself to their midst? In doing these things, she learned where she lacked, and with the knowledge of her weakness came her strength. And so mightily did she strive that her three trainers often marveled late into the night over the eternal mystery of woman. In this way, Thanksgiving night drew near. At irregular intervals, Bettles sent word down from Stewart River regarding the welfare of young Cal. The time of their return was approaching. More than once a casual caller, hearing dance music and the rhythmic pulse of feet, entered only to find Harrington scraping away, and the other two beating time or arguing noisily over a mooted step. Madeline was never in evidence, having precipitately fled to the inner room. On one of these nights, Cal Galbraith dropped in. Encouraging news had just come down from Stewart River, and Madeline had surpassed herself. Not in walk alone, and carriage and grace, but in womanly roguishness. They had indulged in sharp repartee, and she had defended herself brilliantly. And then, yielding to the intoxication of the moment and of her own power, she had bullied and mastered and wheedled and patronized them with most astonishing success. And instinctively, involuntarily, they had bowed, not to her beauty, her wisdom, her wit, but to that indefinable something in woman to which man yields, yet cannot name. The room was dizzy with sheer delight as she and Prince whirled through the last dance of the evening. Harrington was throwing in inconceivable flourishes, while Malamute Kid, utterly abandoned, had seized the broom and was executing mad gyrations on his own account. At this instant the door shook with a heavy rap-rap, and their quick glances noted the lifting of the latch. But they had survived similar situations before. Harrington never broke a note. Madeline shot through the waiting door to the inner room. The broom went hurtling under the bunk, and by the time Cal Galbraith and Louis Savoy got their heads in, Malamute Kid and Prince were in each other's arms, wildly schottishing down the room. As a rule, Indian women do not make a practice of fainting on provocation, but Madeline came as near to it as she ever had in her life. For an hour she crouched on the floor, listening to the heavy voices of the men rumbling up and down in mimic thunder. Like familiar chords of childhood melodies, every intonation, every trick of her husband's voice swept in upon her, fluttering her heart and weakening her knees till she lay half fainting against the door. It was well she could neither see nor hear when he took his departure.
"When do you expect to go back to Circle City?" Malamute Kid asked simply.
"Haven't thought much about it," he replied. Don't think till after the ice breaks. And Madeline?
He flushed at the question, and there was a quick droop to his eyes. Malamute Kid could have despised him for that had he known men less. As it was, his gorge rose against the wives and daughters who had come into the land, and not satisfied with usurping the place of the native women, had put unclean thoughts in the heads of the men and made them ashamed.
"I guess she's all right," the Circle City King answered hastily, and in an apologetic manner. "Tom Dixon's got charge of my interests, you know, and he sees to it that she has everything she wants."
Malamute Kid laid hand upon his arm and hushed him suddenly. They had stepped without. Overhead, the aurora, a gorgeous wanton flaunting miracles of color. Beneath lay the sleeping town. Far below, a solitary dog gave tongue. The king again began to speak, but the kid pressed his hand for silence. The sound multiplied. Dog after dog took up the strain till the full-throated chorus swayed the night. To him who hears for the first time this weird song is told the first and greatest secret of the Northland. To him who has heard it often, it is the solemn knell of lost endeavor. It is the plaint of tortured souls, for in it is invested the heritage of the North, the suffering of countless generations, the warning and the requiem to the world's estrays. Cal Galbraith shivered slightly as it died away in half-caught sobs. The kid read his thoughts openly and wandered back with him through all the weary days of famine and disease. And with him was also the patient Madeline, sharing his pains and perils, never doubting, never complaining. His mind's retina vibrated to a score of pictures, stern, clear-cut, and the hands of the past drew back with heavy fingers on his heart. It was the psychological moment. Malamute Kid was half tempted to play his reserve card and win the game, but the lesson was too mild as yet, and he let it pass. The next instant they gripped hands and the king's beaded moccasins were drawing protests from the outraged snow as he crunched down the hill. Madeline, in collapse, was another woman to the mischievous creature of an hour before, whose laughter had been so infectious and whose heightened color and flashing eyes had made her teachers for the while forget. Weak and nerveless, she sat in the chair just as she had been dropped there by Prince and Harrington. Malamute Kid frowned. This would never do. When the time of meeting her husband came to hand, she must carry things off with high-handed imperiousness. It was very necessary she should do it after the manner of white women, else the victory would be no victory at all. So he talked to her, sternly, without mincing of words, and initiated her into the weaknesses of his own sex, till she came to understand what simpletons men were after all, and why the world of their women was law. A few days before Thanksgiving night, Malamute Kid made another call on Mrs. Eppingwell. She promptly overhauled her feminine fripperies, paid a protracted visit to the dry goods department of the PC Company, and returned with the kid to make Madeline's acquaintance. After that came a period such as the cabin had never seen before, and what with cutting and fitting and basting and stitching, and numerous other wonderful and unknowable things, the male conspirators were more often banished the premises than not. At such times the opera house opened its double storm doors to them. So often did they put their heads together, and so deeply did they drink to curious toasts, that the loungers scented unknown creeks of incalculable richness, and it is known that several Chichiquas and at least one old-timer kept their stampeding packs stored behind the bar, ready to hit the trail at a moment's notice. Mrs. Eppingwell was a woman of capacity, so, when she turned Madeline over to her trainers on Thanksgiving night, she was so transformed that they were almost afraid of her. Prince wrapped a Hudson Bay blanket about her with a mock reverence more real than feigned, while Malamute Kid, whose arm she had taken, found it a severe trial to resume his wanted mentorship. Harrington, with the list of purchases still running through his head, dragged along in the rear, nor opened his mouth once all the way down into town. When they came to the back door of the opera house, they took the blanket from Madeline's shoulders and spread it on the snow. Slipping out of Prince's moccasins, she stepped upon it in new satin slippers. The masquerade was at its height. She hesitated, but they jerked open the door and shoved her in. Then they ran around to come in by the front entrance. 3.
"Where is Freda?" the old-timers questioned, while the Chichiquas were equally energetic in asking who Freda was. The ballroom buzzed with her name. It was on everybody's lips. Grizzled sourdough boys, day laborers at the mines but proud of their degree, either patronized the spruce-looking tenderfeet and lied eloquently, the sourdough boys being specially created to toy with truth, or gave them savage looks of indignation because of their ignorance. Perhaps 40 kings of the upper and lower countries were on the floor, each deeming himself hot on the trail and sturdily backing his judgment with the yellow dust of the realm. An assistant was sent to the man at the scales upon whom had fallen the burden of weighing up the sacks, while several of the gamblers, with the rules of chance at their finger ends, made up alluring books on the field and favorites. Which was Freda? Time and again the Greek dancer was thought to have been discovered, but each discovery brought panic to the betting ring and a frantic registering of new wagers by those who wished to hedge. Malamute Kid took an interest in the hunt, his advent being hailed uproariously by the revelers, who knew him to be a man. The kid had a good eye for the trick of a step, an ear for the lilt of a voice, and his private choice was a marvelous creature who scintillated as the Aurora Borealis. But the Greek dancer was too subtle for even his penetration. The majority of the gold hunters seemed to have centered their verdict on the Russian princess, who was the most graceful in the room, and hence could be no other than Freda Moloff. During a quadrille, a roar of satisfaction went up. She was discovered. At previous balls in the figure, all hands round, Freda had displayed an inimitable step and variation peculiarly her own. As the figure was called, the Russian princess gave the unique rhythm to limb and body. A chorus of I told you so's shook the square roof beams when, lo, it was noticed that Aurora Borealis and another mask, the Spirit of the Pole, were performing the same trick equally well. And when two twin sun dogs and a frost queen followed suit, a second assistant was dispatched to the aid of the man at the scales. Bettles came off trail in the midst of the excitement, descending upon them in a hurricane of frost. His rimed brows turned to the cataracts as he whirled about. His mustache, still frozen, seemed gemmed with diamonds and turned to light in varicolored rays, while the flying feet slipped on the chunks of ice which rattled from his moccasins and German socks. A Northland dance is quite an informal affair, the men of the creeks and trails having lost whatever fastidiousness they might have at once time possessed, and only in the high official circles are conventions at all observed. Here caste carried no significance. Millionaires and paupers, dog drivers and mounted policemen, joined hands with ladies in the center, and swept around the circle performing most remarkable capers. Primitive in their pleasure, boisterous and rough, they displayed no rudeness, but rather a crude chivalry, more genuine than the most polished courtesy. In his quest for the Greek dancer, Cal Galbraith managed to get into the same set with the Russian princess, toward whom popular suspicion had turned. But by the time he had guided her through one dance, he was willing not only to stake his millions that she was not Freda, but that he had had his arm about her waist before. When or where, he could not tell, but the puzzling sense of familiarity so wrought upon him that he turned his attention to the discovery of her identity. Malamute Kid might have aided him instead of occasionally taking the princess for a few turns and talking earnestly to her in low tones, but it was Jack Harrington who paid the Russian princess the most assiduous court. Once he drew Cal Galbraith aside and hazarded wild guesses as to who she was, and explained to him that he was going in to win. That rankled the Circle City King, for man is not by nature monogamic, and he forgot both Madeline and Freda in the new quest. It was soon noised about that the Russian princess was not Freda Moloff. Interest deepened. Here was a fresh enigma. They knew Freda, though they could not find her, but here was somebody they had found and did not know. Even the women could not place her, and they knew every good dancer in the camp. Many took her for one of the official clique, indulging in a silly escapade. Not a few asserted she would disappear before the unmasking. Others were equally positive that she was the woman reporter of the Kansas City Star, come to write them up at $90 per column. And the men at the scales worked busily. At 1 o'clock, every couple took to the floor. The unmasking began amid laughter and delight, like that of carefree children. There was no end of oohs and ahs as mask after mask was lifted. The scintillating Aurora Borealis became the brawny negress whose income from washing the community's clothes ran about $500 a month. The twin sun dogs discovered mustaches on their upper lips and were recognized as brother fraction kings of El Dorado. In one of the most prominent sets, and the slowest in uncovering, was Cal Galbraith with the Spirit of the Pole. Opposite him was Jack Harrington and the Russian princess. The rest had discovered themselves, yet the Greek dancer was still missing. All eyes were upon the group. Cal Galbraith, in response to their cries, lifted his partner's mask. Freda's wonderful face and brilliant eyes flashed out upon them. A roar went up to be squelched suddenly in the new and absorbing mystery of the Russian princess. Her face was still hidden, and Jack Harrington was struggling with her. The dancers tittered on the tiptoes of expectancy. He crushed her dainty costume roughly, and then the revelers exploded. The joke was on them. They had danced all night with a tabooed native woman. But those that knew, and they were many, ceased abruptly, and a hush fell upon the room. Cal Galbraith crossed over with great strides angrily and spoke to Madeline in polyglot Chinook, but she retained her composure, apparently oblivious to the fact that she was the cynosure of all eyes, and answered him in English. She showed neither fright nor anger, and Malamute Kid chuckled at her well-bred equanimity. The king felt baffled, defeated. His common Sawash wife had passed beyond him.
"Come," he said finally. "Come on home."
"I beg pardon," she replied. "I have agreed to go to supper with Mr. Harrington. Besides, there's no end of dances promised."
Harrington extended his arm to lead her away. He evinced not the slightest disinclination toward showing his back, but Malamute Kid had by this time edged in closer. The Circle City King was stunned. Twice his hand dropped to his belt, and twice the kid gathered himself to spring. But the retreating couple passed through the supper room door, where canned oysters were spread at $5 the plate. The crowd sighed audibly, broke up into couples, and followed them. Freda pouted and went in with Cal Galbraith, but she had a good heart and a sure tongue, and she spoiled his oysters for him. What she said is of no importance, but his face went red and white at intervals, and he swore repeatedly and savagely at himself. The supper room was filled with a pandemonium of voices, which ceased suddenly as Cal Galbraith stepped over to his wife's table. Since the unmasking, considerable weights of dust had been placed as to the outcome, everybody watched with breathless intent. Harrington's blue eyes were steady, but under the overhanging tablecloth a Smith & Wesson balanced on his knee. Madeline looked up casually with little interest.
May I have the next round dance with you?" the king stuttered.
The wife of the king glanced at her card and inclined her head. End of section 8.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 Dream Beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.